You're listening to the Master Passive Income Podcast Network.
This week on the Real Escape Investing Podcast, we take a step back and ask, why does Montreal's housing market function the way it does? From the seigneurial system and colonial land grants to rent control and zoning chaos, I share research from my upcoming book, Squeezed. This is a deep dive into the political economy behind the city's housing contradictions. We trace the evolution of land use and asset classes in Montreal to explain today's quirks. Tenant lifers, underpriced units, and the bureaucratic tangle that frustrates even seasoned landlords. If you've ever asked, why is it like this? This is the episode for you.
Welcome to the Real Escape Investing Podcast, where we guide you to escape the constraints of time, geography, and finance through real estate. And now, here's your host, Terry Schauer.
Hey, real estate fans, I have exciting news to share with you. Our monthly in-person networking events are back. If you're in the Montreal area, and even if you're not, go ahead and grab a ticket for our next event at equitybuildersclub.com/events. I would love to see you out. Hey, real estate fan. So it's summer and I want to do something a little bit different, a little bit interesting. And while this episode is not really going to help you make investing decisions, it is going to give you some cool insights into how the city I love, our city of Montreal, came to look like what it does. And if you're tuning into this episode from somewhere else, from another city, or perhaps not even an urban area, I would encourage you to do a little bit of digging into your local market and the markets that you invest in, just to kind of get a sense for some of this history, because it's really, really cool. And so, you know, I went to school in Montreal and we all did like cours d'histoire in grade 10 and had to go through a lot of this information that taught us about New France and the seigneurial system. But a lot of the stuff that I unearthed in researching for this episode and in researching for my upcoming book, Squeezed, is really new information to me. And while there were like little bits of it that I kind of knew already, just really beginning to understand it in a granular way and to see how Montreal, as the city that we know and love today, came to be and grew up is just like kind of really cool. So, you know, one of the things that is interesting as an investor, a landlord, a property manager in this city is to have in daily interactions with some of these like weird incoherencies, whether it's, you know, tenants who've been living somewhere for 30 years and are paying super cheap rent, or whether it's like some of the bureaucratic nightmares. And that goes from getting permits from the city office to sitting in the towel and like beginning to understand how all of some of these things that seem really like nonsensical to us, like how did some of those things grow up? And so there's one thing, which is like the regulatory and legal environment. And then the other thing has to do with the fact that like, why are the boroughs in this city so radically different? And you kind of can't go from places like Outremont and Westmount to then Hochelaga-Maisonneuve or Ahuntsic and Montreal North. And like, once you spend time like in those communities and working on buildings in those areas, you begin to understand that it's not just the geographic constructions that are different. It's also really the communities and the ways of life that have come to be in those areas that are really radically different from one another. And so, you know, part of what I wanted to do, what I want to do in the book Squeezed, is to like make this clear. So to place next to one another some of the history of the city that made it be the way it is, and then place that next to some of the incoherences that us as the on-the-ground actors in the housing market are actually facing, and to, you know, really put those things one next to the other is really something that like I have not read or seen any research that really does that. So excuse me if you were hoping for tips for, you know, investing. This is not that episode. This is really kind of a historical episode, but like it's super interesting anyway. So what I wanted to do is go all the way back to our 10th grade history class. And for those of you who were educated in Quebec or have kids who are going through this now, you're going to hear echoes of that history class. So Quebec initially was, you know, part of New France. And in that time period, there was the seigneurial land system. And so before that, even there were the indigenous peoples who lived there. And then what happened when the French colonizers came in is that they chopped up the land and gave it to seigneurs who then had habitants. So the habitants were the people who worked the land and were given those like little thin plots of land to work on. And, you know, as a funny anecdotal fact, so, you know, the Montreal Canadiens are called the Habs. Well, that Habs actually comes from les habitants, who were the peasants who lived on the seigneurial land system. So that was really where, how things were before British rule came in and before we had some of the Industrial Revolution happen. And so the next phase of what happened as Quebec and Montreal moved away from that seigneurial, almost feudal system and into the industrial era is that Montreal became a industrial hub and also a shipping hub because of its position on the St. Lawrence. And so, you know, kind of around the mid 1800s is when this took place in Europe. And then let's say between 1850 and 1900 was really when Montreal industrialized. So you had the port activity being really big and then various factories coming in the East End. And then what happened is that a lot of the boroughs that we know and love and recognize today were built up during that time period. And so, you know, for those of you who know me, my first triplex was in Hochelaga-Maisonneuve, and that building was actually built such a long time ago that the property records can't pinpoint a specific year. So the estimated year that that first triplex of mine was built was somewhere around 1890. And those triplexes would have been built by local small builders to house some of that burgeoning factory labor or port labor that really had to live near whatever, you know, industrial activity or port activity was happening at the time. And so that's when, you know, like areas like Hochelaga-Maisonneuve, Verdun, Saint-Henri got built up. You then had areas like Rosemont and Villeray, Petite Patrie, those kind of areas that housed actually the kind of next layer up. So the clerks, the doctors, the shopkeepers, like all of those people who, you know, served the factories or who made money from the laboring classes then lived in those other areas. And when you think today of how Rosemont or Villeray looks, like some of the constructions are quite similar, but the lots are bigger and the areas are somewhat removed from the industrial production. So away from the factories and that area where there would have been, you know, a lot of the working class people who were crowded on top of one another. And then, of course, you have the other areas like Westmount, which at the time was lived in by, you know, the economic elite and the British who, you know, came in and then colonized on top of the French. And so there was really this way in which the city grew. Like today we know that, you know, Saint-Laurent Boulevard roughly divides the city into East and West. But how much do we understand that those divisions really come from that time period where the Anglos settled in the west end of the city away from the industrial areas, and the working class at that time, French Canadians, would have lived in, you know, more of the down and out Hochelaga type neighborhoods. So then, I mean, the other thing that's super interesting, and I think a lot of this us know this anecdotally, but that in the years from 1970 to 2001, 300,000 Anglophones left Montreal. And this would have been just after the Quiet Revolution, where the Quebec separatism really, you know, came up and became more of a factor. And then you started to have Bill 101 and like various separation referendums. And this then started to reshape some of that wealth distribution. And with a lot of the Anglophones leaving, some of those richer areas and like those business, I guess, opportunities really became available to a wider range of people, whether they're new immigrants coming in from outside of Canada. And like, you know, that time period, really the 80s and 90s, was almost like a dark phase for Montreal, where there was a lot of economic instability and a lot of companies moving their head offices to Toronto, and a lot of like job opportunities actually left the city along with a lot of Anglophone money. And so, you know, the other thing that kind of happened was some of those Francophone boroughs really stagnated and ghettoized. And then, you know, one of the other things that's kind of interesting to understand is like, when did this whole, you know, Régie du logement and the standard lease come into effect? And so, you know, the first thing to understand is the first rent control laws came into effect in the 1940s. And if you think back historically on what would have been happening then, that would have been the end of World War II, when a lot of the soldiers were coming back from overseas and there would have been massive population migration. So a lot of people migrating away from Europe and into North America, and that would have then created a real housing crunch. And so the Régie du Logement, now the TAL or Tribunal Administratif du Logement, was founded in 1980. And in 1996, the first standardized Quebec lease was introduced. This then made the thing that there were no security deposits, restricted increases, and no post-vacancy rent resets. And these type of measures are even uncommon in other rent-controlled jurisdictions. The other thing that's really interesting to know is that 67% of Montrealers rent. We are actually the Canadian city with the most renters. The number two position is occupied by Vancouver, which has about a 55% renter proportion. And Toronto's even lower. Only 47% of Torontonians rent their homes. So Montreal has a very, very high rate of rentals, a lot of tenants. We are actually on par with the other North American city that has as many renters, and that is New York. So even if you compare Montreal with the other big cities in the United States, we have one of the highest amount of our residents who are tenants in all of North America on par with New York. So we're tied for first place in that respect. And, you know, this is kind of interesting when you think about the fact that one of the accesses into middle class is really that property ownership thing. And so this is why, you know, we have things like the CMHC, so the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Commission, which helps Canadians buy homes. And so the whole purpose of doing that is to help people transition into middle class life, to have a larger middle class, because that's really one of the things that helps, you know, societies be more peaceful and flourish is when there's a bigger middle class. And so if you think about the fact that 67% of Montrealers rent, so that means that a smaller proportion of people actually own their homes. This should give you a kind of an insight into how Montreal is still really divided on a class perspective, because that ability to move into the middle class ranks is really tied to property ownership. And we just have quite a low rate of that. One of the other things that's interesting is that 70% of rental buildings in Montreal were built before 1980. So that also means that a lot of our housing stock is quite old and has not been invested in over a long period of time. And so this is kind of, you know, when we get back to the aspect of rent control and the fact that, like, you know, if in the history of what I like to say are bad ideas that end up having, you know, unintended consequences, I think rent control is really one of those ideas, right? So it's made to keep people from getting, you know, turned out of their units, and also to control housing costs, because that tends to be people's main expense, is the cost of housing. But then what happens with that is basically the system begins to be built for tenant retention and to have low turnover, because every time units turn over, there's a chance that the rent gets readjusted. Now, even though you're not technically supposed to do that, the mechanism that prevents this rent readjustment is, for those of us who are active in the market, really not alive and well, right? You know, what happens is that this then disincentivizes investors from, you know, putting money into their properties, because if you cannot raise the rent in a meaningful way, it means that the whole real estate park of the city begins to slowly degenerate over time. And, you know, one of the other things that's interesting is that when you think of, like, Montreal's history and the way that the investment took place, like, Montreal had a long dark period in which capital was fleeing and a lot of those moneyed classes were leaving. And, like, for, you know, almost 30 years, there was really significant disinvestment into a lot of our real estate parks. And given the fact that that rent control system is still alive and well, that continues to disincentivize investment. And so you will find that a lot of our housing stock is really, like, quite old and dilapidated because of some of those historical situations. And now, like, the place where I want to leave that is just with, you know, what's happening on the ground today. And in a lot of the research that's out there, there's this thing called the global wall of money, right? And what's happened since the housing crisis in the US in, you know, the early 2000s is that housing has become a global financial asset. And one of the things that you'll realize as you look back historically at what has happened with housing is that, you know, in the time of the Octon, of the indigenous people, like, housing was not an asset. Even in the industrial times, housing was not really an asset in the way that it is today, where, be it, you know, landlords and small-time investors or bigger institutional investors like REITs, pension funds, and private equity that have arrived in Montreal really since the 2000s, like the housing was not a financial asset that was treated the same way, even maybe 40 or 50 years ago, right? Like you had mom and pop landlords who were operating, you know, smaller things, or maybe wealthy families who had a different like real estate assets, but there was not this like institutional money financialized logic that really came into the city. And, you know, what's interesting is that housing over the past 200 years has really shifted from shelter to an investment vehicle. And the result of that is even, you know, smaller investors, mom and pop investors, like maybe, you know, you, if you're listening to this show, really are having to adapt to some of the practices of the professional investors just to keep up and to be able to, you know, make money in a competitive environment. Basically, what we're doing is we're engaged in an arms race. That means that we have to adopt some of those practices and some of those ways in which professional investing institutions operate. And so what happens is that, you know, a lot of renters get squeezed between asset appreciation and regulatory stagnation. And, you know, if I were to say in a nutshell what the topic of my book is, and one of the things that I find so fascinating as being both an investor and an active property manager, where I'm confronted on a daily basis with some of these, you know, weird incoherencies, is that on the one hand, assets are appreciating, and so rents keep going up and up. But on the other side, the regulatory environment is so like stagnated that us as property managers, like we are really taken. We don't have the tools to keep buildings in clean. So, you know, by way of conclusion, like in the risk with a lot of the way that we get our information today is just to look at, you know, a headline view of things and to see like, oh, you know, the housing crisis this or the housing market that. But that actually, unless you take the time to go back that 200 years into the past, like you will not really understand what we see today. And even though some of the policies are well-meaning, a lot of them are outdated. And, you know, also one of the things that I find super interesting in doing this research is to understand that although the city was built up, like now we're in 2025, that's 125 years ago that those first plexes in Hochelaga were built up. But that as we have new people, new renters, new immigrants coming into the city, like they're basically just slotting into those existing communities and the positions that those communities, the types of housing that those communities already existed, right? Like when I have, you know, incoming, let's say more working class people, like they will be coming to rent in those boroughs of Hochelaga, Maisonneuve, or Montreal North, or some of the more lower end boroughs of the city. And, you know, also if you look on the complete flip side at like, you know, who is buying up houses in Westmount, well, that ends up being this transnational capitalist class who has money and who is just slotting into some of that space that's been vacated by the Anglos who left, you know, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And so what I find really fascinating is the fact that like this city that was built up in the industrial era is still functioning in many of the same ways, where you have the working class, the middle class, the upper class still fitting into the same little pigeonholes that were there when the city grew up, you know, 150 years ago. So I find that super fascinating. Anyway, so real estate fam, I hope that you have found a lot of this material as fascinating as I have. I know that like for me, that's a big silver lining in being able to research this book, is to, you know, get a greater, deeper understanding of the city that I live in, how it grew up, where those communities come from, and then to also be able to, you know, understand that us as investors or actors who are responsible for shaping the way those communities continue, and hopefully for, you know, for me, I have a desire to also circulate some of that information, just so that instead of coming out with those hackneyed things of like, oh, the evil landlord or the housing crisis or all of these like very simple explanations of why things are the way they are, and to be critiquing them on a very superficial level, the more that we're able to understand some of the histories of how these policies came to be, and then to be able to like put that next to some of really the regulatory morass that a lot of us actors find ourselves in, and that in the end, nobody is really profiting from, you know, a bunch of red tape that was enacted 50 years ago in situations, and that there ends up being a lot of unintended consequences to that. But that on the flip side, like a lot of the economic reality and the political economy of why the types of housing are different and why financialized logic has come into turn housing into an asset. I mean, that process is alive and well across all of the Western world and even beyond that. And to begin to understand how that's going to affect our communities and, you know, the class structure going forward the next 50 years, like, I think that's really the important question that we need to ask ourselves, you know, as investors, but also as citizens, is to just, you know, look into the future and say, well, okay, as certain aspects of our lives become assetized, and perhaps that price tag associated with joining the middle class through becoming a homeowner is just becoming more and more out of reach of certainly young people and, you know, work upwardly mobile working and middle class people, like, there is going to be an effect of that on our society and how it continues to evolve. And I think that, you know, rather than throwing back and forth accusations of, you know, the evil investor or the evil tenant, like, maybe these are some of the questions that we should sit down and ask ourselves together, because, you know, us as humble residents of Montreal, like, this global wall of money and what's happening in housing as an asset class, like, this is going to affect all of us and affect us all in different ways. So, real estate fan, if you found this interesting, please go ahead and share this show with any one of your people that you know. Hopefully it's going to help get some actual research and data out there as, you know, real talking points and not just stuff that gets, you know, said on the news back and forth. And of course, when Squeezed is in a more ship-shaped form, we will be able to throw that up for pre-order so that you can be one of the first people to get a copy of that book when it comes out, probably sometimes in early 2026. The second exciting thing is that we still have a few more coaching spots available in our next cohort. If you would like to have a little bit more help closing on that next property, please go ahead and fill out the contact form on equitybuildersclub.com, and we would be happy to jump on a call and explain to you a little bit more about what we do.
Thank you for listening to the Real Escape Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Terry Schauer. If you find that this show has been useful to you, if you've enjoyed the content, if it's done anything to move the needle for you, please go ahead and share it with one person who you think could profit from listening to it. Until next time, real estate fans.